Leon Panetta 2016 Lecture Series, An America in Renaissance or Decline, The Challenges Facing a New President. This lecture discusses jobs, debt, and taxes. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mrs. Sylvia Panetta.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome once again to the Sunset Cultural Center in beautiful Carmel by the Sea for the Leon Panetta 2016 Lecture Series. Last month's event was one of the most successful in the history of the program, and with strong turnout this afternoon for our student program and a full house tonight, I think it's clear that the lecture series feels at home in our new location. The four discussions we hold each spring make up the Panetta Institute's landmark program. Their prominence is not only because of the size of the audience in the theater or the wide range of viewers in the television broadcast. The importance of these lectures rests in the topics we address and the conversations we hold. Secretary Panetta and I believe that this year's lectures are particularly important. As our nation prepares for the presidential election, our country and our democracy are very much at a crossroads. When we consider who will lead our nation into the next decade, we must also consider how he or she will lead. Will our next president bring our nation together to find compromise on the issues that threaten our way of life? Will he or she be able to govern, to learn from the lessons of history? What must be done to give our children a better life? Such an approach defines a true leader and statesman in all arenas, and it is especially essential when we consider our economy. It's been 8 years since the global financial crisis. In that time, the world community has tried to respond, to combat and protect against another crisis through a variety of measures, including a stimulus spending, monetary policy, and regulatory reforms. And yet, today, we're faced with staggering national debt, political dysfunction, social unrest, and a deep pessimism about our economic future. A poll in the late 2015 found that a significant amount of Americans are pessimistic about the future of the United States economy, with 57% holding the view that hard work will not necessarily be rewarded, and only one-third reporting a belief that their family's financial situation is secure. Tonight, we discuss their concerns about jobs, debt, and taxes. The United States is the world's leading economy, but there is the strong possibility that it will lose this title during the course of the next presidential administration. The next president must lead our nation through a new global economy, addressing issues of trade, labor, and most importantly, opportunity. How can we have free trade that is also fair trade? Can technology be a source of innovation and economic growth without threatening employment? Can we reform our system of taxation so that it is transparent, fair, and comprehensible? Most importantly, how can we encourage greater attention to these issues in the presidential contest? Our first guest began his political career as an aide to United States Senator Richard Lugar before becoming a senior advisor and political director to President Ronald Reagan in 1984. In January 2001, he was sworn in as director of the Office of Management and Budget under President George W. Bush. During his 2.5 years in the administration, He helped design and present the administration's tax cuts and was the main architect of the president's budget. First elected governor of Indiana in 2004, he was reelected in 2008, receiving more votes than any candidate for any public office in the state's history. In 2005, he led Indiana to its first balanced budget in 8 years, and without a tax increase, transformed the nearly $800 million deficit he inherited into an annual surplus of $370 million within the following year. Presently, he is serving as the president of Purdue University. He and Secretary Panetta are co-chairs of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. In that role, he continues to stress the need to address national debt and entitlement reform. A distinguished public service, please welcome Governor Mitch Daniels. Welcome.
Talk to you
all. Our second guest is a leading expert on debt, the deficit, and the global economy. He has served as a member of the panel of economic advisors to the Congressional Budget Office, a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and a research fellow at the American Bar Foundation. He was an economic advisor to Barack Obama's 2004 Senate campaign before serving as a senior economic advisor to then-Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. When President Obama was elected, he was appointed as a member of the Council of Economic Advisors. Later, he served as staff director and chief economist of President Obama's Economic Recovery Advisory Board, which provided the independent, nonpartisan information, analysis, and advice on economic recovery. As chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, he was one of President Obama's chief consultants in guiding the administration's macroeconomic policy and reform of the financial system, as well as a primary spokesperson on the economy. A distinguished economist, please welcome Dr. Austin Goolsbee. Our final guest has been a familiar voice on business, television, and radio for nearly three decades. Known for his sharp perspective on the financial markets and the economy, he gained firsthand knowledge of the markets when he worked as the CEO of Insana Capital Partners from 2006 to 2008. He has written for Money Magazine and USA Today and has authored four books about Wall Street and the financial markets. Additionally, he is the editor of Insana's Market Intelligence, an internet-based newsletter. Well known for his high-profile interviews, he has spoken with Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, as well as business magnates Warren Buffett, George Soros, Bill Gates, and Steve Jobs. Among his many honors, he was named one of the top 100 business news journalists of the 20th century and was nominated for a news and documentary Emmy for his role in NBC's coverage of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. During Secretary Panetta's tour of duty as director of the CIA and Secretary of Defense, Mr. Insana moderated several Panetta Institute lectures on the budget and on the economy. A distinguished commentator on finance and the markets, please welcome Ron Insana.
Thank you very much.
And finally, moderating the discussion is the man who created this lecture series 19 years ago. In addition to his work as chairman of the Panetta Institute, former director of the CIA and former Secretary of Defense. Please remember, he was chairman of the Congressional House Budget Committee and director of the Office of Management and Budget, and through his work in the Clinton administration, helped lead the nation from an era of large deficits to a balanced budget and a new era of equally large surpluses. Please welcome Secretary Leon B. Panetta.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the second forum in our Panetta Lecture Series. We've had a theme related to America in Renaissance or America in Decline, the challenges facing the next president of the United States. Last lecture, as you know, we talked about foreign policy and the threat of terrorism. Tonight, we talk about the economy. We talk about jobs, we talk about debt, we talk about taxes, and we'll talk about trade, as well as a number of other issues. All of this is taking place at kind of a strange time in our history. We've got the strangest presidential campaign that I've seen in my lifetime. And as I've mentioned, part of it is reality TV, but part of it is like we've all gone into the rabbit hole in Alice in Wonderland. And there are some characters that are familiar. One is the Mad Hatter. The other is the Cheshire Cat. Then we've got an old rabbit, and we've got Alice. All part of this campaign. But, you know, the fact is that these presidential candidates are all talking about trying to deal with economic issues. And yet, when it comes to the specifics about how they pay for these programs, how do we deal with the debt, how do we deal with tax reform, how do we deal with entitlement reform, all of the issues that relate to fiscal policy, we're not getting a lot of specifics. And James Carville once said that in the first campaign for Bill Clinton that it's the economy, stupid. And I think the fact is that it is the economy, stupid, and people ultimately will vote their pocketbooks. And so for that reason, I think it's important for us to explore the issues related to the economy tonight with these three very distinguished speakers that we have. And I want to start with the first question. I asked this question in the last lecture to lead off, but I think it's important. Next president of the United States walks into the Oval Office facing this huge debt, facing a situation where there continues to be instability in the global world, facing a situation where there's a lot of gridlock in Washington. And he asks you, he or she, excuse me, asks you if what is your best advice to the next president about what that president should do in dealing with the economy and how to make sure that we put our economy on the right path for the future? Mitch?
I would tell that president that the first aspiration you should have is to try to unify this country, to break clean with the, destructive tendency on both sides of our politics in recent years, to divide, to castigate, personalize politics, and to say to America, you know, we're going to get out of this, and then to identify at least one thing that, if you, by then I hope you have identified it, on which maybe people can come together. It doesn't have to be the most important of all the steps on the economic menu or the fiscal menu, But I think the country needs to see a demonstration. First, it needs to hear words of unity, which it has not heard for a long time. And secondly, it needs to see some tangible demonstration. I remember former Secretary Schultz, we were talking about, once saying that, I guess it's an old French diplomatic phrase, why does the Frenchman kiss the lady's hand? Because he has to start somewhere. And we got to start somewhere. So so we can talk later about what that first step might be, but you know, certainly it was my experience in public life that you can build a positive momentum. I think people speak are incorrectly when they talk about political capital as something that is spent and then gone. Like other forms of capital, if well invested, it brings a return, which then can be invested in the next goal. So I would look for something. Maybe it could be a form of tax reform. Maybe it could be a revival of Simpson Bowles. But I think more important to see some forward motion than that it's necessarily the single best goal.
Austin, you've been in that place before.
So. Yes, I'm kind of intrigued by that as the single best goal. In a way, it's a testament to the Panetta Daniels approach to politics to do that. I think we've had a little bit the dynamic that has worked the opposite, which was the politics of our nation has not been seeking things that we could agree on, but instead precisely define the things that we did not agree on. So there have been, over the last 4 or 5 years, even in the midst of a lot of gridlock and a lot of poisonous stuff, there have been things that the two parties did together. It's just they kind of say, yeah, well, who cares about those? If you agree, that's not interesting. You know, we want to find them fighting about stuff. So it's through this campaign, we have converted from it's the economy stupid to it's the stupid economy. And, you know, no, you're stupid. No, you're stupid. You know, so we have that going. If you ask me, I would give two things. The first is I would strongly advise don't think of this as a crisis. Stop being in crisis mode. We have been in a crisis, and my fear is when you are in crisis, you cease making the investments that you need to make. Because you say, look, we're not thinking about what are we going to need in 20 years. We have to make sure there's not going to be a depression by Friday. And I think we need to get out of that mentality now. I think we're growing modestly, but we're not in crisis anymore. And then the second, just on straight policy, I think that where growth comes from is especially investing in your own people. I'm sure we will get to some of these issues about the skills of the American workforce. I would say I find it dangerous that we're going to cut financial aid, that we're going to cut scientific investment, health investment, that we're not going to invest in public infrastructure. And those are three areas. I know you asked for one, but you know, I'm going to call that one. Investing in the future growth rate, I think, is the most important thing.
Ron?
Well, you know, I think the campaign has all been about talking the country down, which is unusual for a hotly contested political campaign where, you know, Ronald Reagan talked about morning in America and Donald Trump wants to make the country great again, as if we're no longer great, which we truly still are. Particularly when compared to the rest of the world, there are very few places you can look and say, I'd rather be there. Or Bernie Sanders is saying the entire system is rigged. That language has to disappear, and I think the president is the one who has the bully pulpit, who is the cheerleader that needs to stand up on day one and say, listen, we're fine. We are still the greatest country on the face of the earth. The experiment goes on. And then he or she needs to outline immediately a comprehensive strategy for growth. And that's the only thing I would focus on. And it would have aspects of what both Governor Daniels and what Austin had suggested, but I think it really has to be spelled out immediately in a comprehensive manner, whether it's coherent energy policy, infrastructure investment, supporting technological research and development. All those things need to be enumerated so that people do feel that there's a plan on day one and that the next president hits the ground running.
What do each of you think about the state of the economy? I mean, we came through, obviously, one of the worst crises since the 30s. We seem to be in a recovery mode. Obviously, unemployment's down. There's some other good things happening. But at the same time, very anemic growth. We're still looking at a lot of instability in the world right now. What do you think is the state of the economy that we're in right now? And how long do you think that this period is going to last? Al? Austin?
I would say I don't think it's that great, but I don't think it's that bad. For the short run, I'm going to define as, let's call it 18 months. I think the Fed is the most public, most publicly mistaken, but they're not alone in their forecast. So for 30 quarters in a row, the Fed has forecasted that by next year, we would be taking off and we will have 3.5% growth. And they said in 09, that would be in 10, and 10, it would be 11, 11, 12, and they continue. And now they announce, well, it won't be 16, but 17 is going to be the year when we finally have U-shaped growth. You know, we went from, it would be V-shaped recovery, they're describing U-shaped recovery. By the time I left, they described it as the L-shaped recovery, which I was like, what is it? That's not even a recovery shape. What do you mean L-shaped? We moved to the Arabic script and whatever it is, you know, to get it going. And I think that what has happened is that there are some pretty deep fundamental transformations taking place in the economy. Transformations like that are slow going. We had a bubble. And we only ever had V-shaped recoveries when you could go back to what the economy was doing before the recession began. And when a bubble pops, you can't. And so we are slowly moving to more export-based, more capital investment-based, more innovation-led growth. It's just that involved people got to move from Detroit where there aren't jobs, and they got to move to California or Texas or something where it's growing, and people got to get retrained and stuff like that. So as a result, I don't think for the next 18 months it's going to be any better, really, than it has been for the last 5 years, which is kind of, it's going okay, but it's not that great. And outside of the U.S., I'm quite nervous that it might be much worse than that. If you look at either Europe or China, major red flags that they could have a serious problem.
Ron, what are you telling your viewers these days about the state of the economy?
Well, I tend to agree with Austin, and I think most of the serious risks exist outside the United States, unless we were to see a policy error by the Fed. If they were to raise interest rates on multiple occasions and do it in such a way that it had a negative feedback effect on the rest of the world, I think we would restart a cycle that's very much a negative one. Just to go back a little bit, I think it's somewhat miraculous that we are where we are, given what happened in 2008 and early 2009. For those of us who were working in the financial services industry at that time and watched people take 3 years of their life savings out of the bank, put it in a safe at home, and buy a gun, we forget, and some canned food to go with it, we forget that there were people who were truly concerned that the banks were not only going to go under, but then ultimately be nationalized, and a whole series of events would take place that would cascade like the 1930s. And yet, the economy has grown, albeit slowly, as you say. Unemployment's all the way back to 5% from 10 and change. Stock market has tripled. Household net worth is at an all-time high. A lot of good things have happened. Auto sales are at record highs. Now, some of that's been goosed by subprime lending and things like that. But generally speaking, if you were to compare this to the 30s experience, which from a financial crisis perspective was comparable, we came out okay. Where we sit now, I think, is the danger is China imploding, which I think is a high probability. Europe, almost every other country in the world is in recession right now. Venezuela is a failed state. Brazil is now in the process of collapsing inward on itself. And the Middle East, geopolitical risk there, and in the South China Sea. I think there are a lot of dominoes this year that could fall, that could disrupt growth. But again, I think it's an intermediate term issue, not a longer term issue for the U.S.
Mitch?
These guys were right, three-fourths of America wouldn't think we're on the wrong track and have a lousy economy.
unemployment rate is, I was raised to think that was the most important political indicator, if you wanted to know sort of what was. It's meaningless these days. What's it called? U6, Austin? Yeah. You know, that's the rate you want to look at. It's 10%. You know,
yeah, but it's down from 20. Yeah, exactly.
No. When you add back temporary workers, part-time workers, people who are underemployed, and can consider how many people have gotten discouraged and dropped out of the workforce altogether, it's not a happy thing. Now, I'm in this fabulous community of yours. I don't know how it looks from here, but let me tell you how it looks from the middle of the country. And it's not very pretty. This country cannot, first of all, we cannot solve the problems that bother us the most. The questions around upward mobility, therefore the questions about equality of opportunity and income. And beyond that, as far as I'm concerned, the confidence that a free society needs in order to keep operating by consent of the governed. You know, I'd love to believe that Americans have supported our Republican form of government because they all read the Federalist Papers and got carried away by it. But no, it's been the promise of economic improvement and the next generation living better than this one and all that, that has maintained confidence in the system. And I think that's what ought to worry us the most at this point, because it's fraying around the edges. You're talking about nationalizing banks. They almost, maybe not by legal terms, but
almost close.
Yeah, we've come pretty close to doing that, Ron. So, no, I think we cannot be a successful society limping along at 1.x% growth rates, and if there's anything one wishes people from left to right could agree on, it's that. And if you care about poor people, if you care about upward mobility, and you're worried about income inequality, then you've got to be for something much faster than what's going on right, growth that's faster than what's going on right now. And frankly, much of national policy leans against it, and we ought to review that.
Let me just quick answer. What are the chances of slipping into another recession in the next 2 to 3 years?
Next 2 to 3 years, I think you could get a cyclical recession in an ongoing recovery, just like you can have a cyclical bear market in an ongoing secular bull market, which I think we're in. But that risk always exists. I mean, we've had long-term recoveries that have had short-term recessions. The bigger risk is again, and I agree entirely with Austin, if China, Europe, Japan, Australia, Russia, the Middle East, Canada, Venezuela, Brazil, they're all in recession. It's hard for the U.S. growing at 1 to 2% not to be slowed further by that. So I think the risk is over 40% that we'll see something like a recession in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say in the next 12 months.
Yeah.
I was still going to give you a decently high number, 25%, 30% in the next 12 months, because if they have a kind of a hard landing in China, which is entirely possible, if not likely,
if it hasn't happened already.
I don't think it's realistic that you could have the second biggest economy in the world really suck wind and that the U.S. not have a recession. Even though it's not that big of a share directly, I just think markets will freak out. I think people will scale back their activity.
Mitch?
Now I'm going to defer to them. I would worry about it too. I mean, we're not very far. We've been sort of staggering along, not very far above the line as it is. So I agree that it wouldn't take much of an exogenous shock to turn the ink from black to red.
All right, so let's talk about one of those problems that nobody wants to deal with, which is the national debt. It's $19.2 trillion, and we're paying now huge interest rates. But the projection by CBO is that, we're looking at that debt increasing to 84-85% of GDP in the next 10 years. The concern obviously is what the impact of that will be ultimately in terms of our economy. Let me ask you this, how big a threat is the national debt to our economy, number one, and number two, how do we deal with it? Mitch, I'll start with you.
Well, I think it's an enormous threat, in fact, it's the problem, I think, that should preoccupy us the most. recognizing that national security is the first responsibility of any government, and your series was right to start with that, and I don't want to minimize the dangers there. But I, on most days, I think the greatest danger to the future of our country is our apparent inability to come to terms with this problem as it compounds, becomes worse and worse. And, you know, there's an old British saying, now that the money has run out, we shall have to begin to think. And, you know, for my money, we're there. You know, it is, I think, economically provable that debt levels like that weigh on present growth. They're an enormous threat to future growth. Where are you going to find the money to invest in the perfectly worthy goals that Austin talked about? You know, so-called discretionary part of the budget has shrunk. I looked, Leon, since the previous administration, it was already down to 35%, it's down to 29% now. And the only reason it's not 24% is because we have artificially low interest rates. And so it is constraining our ability to do those affirmative things that we'd like to do, even as it threatens to crowd out and choke off the private investment that growth depends on. So to me, it is the domestic issue, and neither party, as far as I'm concerned, deserves any credit for dealing with it, at least lately.
I would say I believe it's a good news, bad news, good news story in the following sense. The good news is the $19 trillion number is overstated because there's a lot of one side of the government owns the debt, so it shouldn't really be counted as debt and thought of that way. It's a bad news story because it's way understates the true debt because the promises we've made on Social Security and on Medicare imply these unfunded and unaccounted for what we would think of as debts that are vastly in excess of $19 trillion. But ultimately, I think the good news is that to get this, and what matters is your the share of your, what is your debt payment to your income? Okay, so as you get richer, it tends to be that the amount of mortgage debt that families have goes up with their income. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't afford it. What matters is what your debt to GDP ratio. And to get that in a stabilized and manageable way is a serious problem, but is not unmanageable at all, is not explosive. And for anybody who asks the question, a lot of the times they'll say, are we Greece? They will also say, is Illinois Greece? You know, I'm in Illinois. Now, Illinois might be Greece, but the U.S. overall is not Greece because that really misunderstands what the problem is facing a country like Greece or Italy or Spain or even the U.K. or Japan, which is they already have debt to GDP ratios well above the U.S. ratio. They already have income tax rates well above the U.S. rates, and they have 20% VATs, and they have much worse demographics, and they're already spending much higher shares of their economy on government spending. So they don't, I would say they don't have a plan B. They don't really have a plan A. That's why the market goes to them and says, what are you going to do? The U.S. is blessed and cursed with the fact that our debt capacity, I believe, is well vastly in excess of where we are. And the world recognizes we could do it by cutting our spending, i.e. change the promises on entitlements that people think they got. We could do it by raising taxes. If we could get the growth rate up, we could do it some by faster growth. But we have many options, and we could do some combination of them. I think, ultimately, I'm not as worried because I think Washington can solve a problem like that. Eventually, there will be a moment when people will come together, and the Washington solution to things is everybody gets a third of what they want. And I think that's basically the right answer on this, on the deficit.
Ron?
I view it as a good news, bad news, good news, bad news scenario. No, I tend to agree with Austin and Governor Daniels, but I think there's a couple of things that are still working in our favor, which is that we're the only largest net debtor in the history of the world that's allowed to borrow in its own currency. So to the extent that we don't have a currency crisis and our external debt service costs don't go up, there's a very large appetite for the safest single investment in the world, which is U.S. Treasury bonds. I think there are a couple of easy, quick fixes. When I was subbing for you several years ago with Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, their comments just about means testing Social Security and altering the eligibility ages would extend the solvency of both by 75 and 85 years, respectively. Now, Chris Christie was, you know, loudly harangued for suggesting we should take the retirement age automatically to 70 starting today. It's not such a crazy thing. The life expectancy now, if you make 65, is at least 81. And the crazy thing about living in the United States is that the older you get, the older you're expected to get. Which means if you're going to make 90, 95, you should be working probably anyway, just for your own sanity. I mean, you can only watch so much daytime television, you know. I'll spend plenty of time with the Kardashians, but I got to do something else somewhere in my day. But those are relatively modest, and you know this, that everybody knows what the fix is.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to remove some of those unfunded liabilities. On the other issues, you know, they're a little tougher, but particularly, let's say, the defense side. I don't think it's an immediate crisis, and I don't think necessarily, and we talked about this in the last panel, I don't think we'll necessarily do anything unless it becomes a crisis.
Mitch, does it disturb you that, presidential candidates are promising an awful lot, and the committee that we're on has basically looked at Trump's proposals and Sanders' proposals, and it looks like they add somewhere close to $15 trillion to the debt. And yet there's very little discussion, even in the debates, little discussion about...
You could have stopped right there.
Yeah.
There's little discussion.
You know, okay, if you're serious about dealing with the deficit, you know, you got to deal with discretionary spending, you got to deal with entitlements, you have to deal with defense, you have to deal with taxes. That's the bottom line. But there's no will or even discussion of that. And you know what's going on?
Yeah, well, a friend of mine says we're suffering from deficit attention disorder. Because, you know, we just aren't paying. Here's this monstrous moose, you know, smelly moose in the room, and nobody wants to talk about it. And I understand why. I mean, to some extent, we've just been desensitized. As the zeros accumulate, these are numbers. Maybe Austin can come to terms with them or Ron, but most of us can't, you know. You shouldn't get used to things like that. We had four daughters, and I always say that when the first one caught a cold, we rushed her to the emergency room, and when the fourth one swallowed a quarter, I took it out of her allowance. You can get used to things you really shouldn't.
Yeah, but it's a little different because you were subsequently reimbursed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fine to say, and it may be prophetic to say, well, we'll just wait till we have a huge crisis and then we'll deal with it. That would be tragic because if we would get started, we are a fortunate country, and Ron gave us one of the most important reasons why. The world chooses to use our currency. It would be darn inconvenient to switch. We are the best house in a slum neighborhood right now in terms of the world economy. So the world will bridge finance this country if we would just get started. We cannot solve this problem. Arithmetically, it is already beyond us. We're going to renege in one way or another. You have to change the promises or debauch the currency. That's how fading empires deal with excessive debt. But it would be great to get started. And the last thing I'll say is that it's especially unhelpful when politicians, and we've got them on both sides now, not only don't tell the truth about our fix, but suggest that you can just add more to it. The American people have been actively misled, for instance, about how Social Security works. They think it's their money, by gosh. I paid it in, you know. They're getting back a huge multiple of what they paid in. They paid for, you know, everybody in this room knows how it works. You paid for yesterday's retirees, and And young people are going to pay for yours, except there aren't going to be enough of them, and they're not going to have enough dollars to pay for it. And this is known in the literature as of Social Security as the noble lie. I don't know if a lie can be noble, but people were led to believe this. And we've got to start with people in public life saying, no, folks, actually, not the way it works. And we're going to have to make a few adjustments, because you don't want to knowingly plunder your children, do you?
I would disagree a little bit in the following sense. We go through a recession of 2008-2009.
You'd let her keep the quarter? Is that your... whoever
got the quarter, they deserve to keep the quarter. I had a friend, a guy was my debate partner. I guess when he was a kid, he was six, and he put a screw in his mouth, and his mom was like, "You give me that screw right now. That is not safe. You do." And he's a very stubborn guy, and she was like, "You give that to me right now, or I would put it." And he purposely swallowed it, and she produced that screw at his wedding, and she's like, "It took me 4 days to get this through." And she was like, and he gave it to his wife. She's like, "I'm giving this to you now. He's your problem." But the only things I want to say is this. We had the worst recession of our lifetimes. Everybody who's in this world of economics and debt knows that recessions equal deficits, because people's income goes down, so you don't get revenues, and there's a bunch of automatic stabilizers that go up. So the deficit explodes to a record level. That explosion had nothing to do with the long-term fiscal challenge facing the country, nothing. And yet, it was unfortunately misleading in the same way. So in the way that it was, everybody's pretending there's no deficit, turning that into, look, this is all about the stimulus has created our problem. That was completely wrong. That has nothing to do with it. It's about the aging of the population, and their healthcare costs. But recognize you don't have to balance the budget to stabilize and bring your debt to GDP ratio into a manageable size. And if we run something like 2 to 2.5% of GDP deficits every year, we will still, as long as we're growing 2 to 2.5% a year, we can have our debt to GDP ratio coming down. The problem is, so we looked at Simpson-Bowles, and that was the starting of the Simpson-Bowles Commission, as they said, let's try to stabilize the debt to GDP ratio and start it shrinking. How much do we need to cut deficits or raise revenue to do that? And they had an interesting plan. It had some discretionary cuts, had some entitlements, had some revenue. Both sides, for reasons we can go through, said, nope, totally unacceptable, can't do it. A bunch of people would ask me, I'm at the CEA, so the people I'm talking to are concerned about the deficit. They say, you need to find out, why isn't the president proposing Bowles-Simpson? Why doesn't he just say, I'm for Bowles-Simpson? So I asked the guy who runs the focus groups for the White House. I said, what do people think about, whatever? What do they think about taxes, capital gains taxes, this? What about Bowles-Simpson? He said, Bowles-Simpson, you know what the problem is? He said, you and all the people who hire me, he also does stuff for private companies. He said, the people who hire me all want to know about Bowles-Simpson. And the people that I interview in the focus groups all think that that's a stomach condition. And they feel like that's not on their radar screen at all. And so I think Governor Daniels is right. In a way, we've had deficit avoidance disorder.
Let me, before I go to the questions, let me just ask about this question, because it's one that's getting a lot of attention now, which is the question about, the hollowing out of the middle class, the inequality that we have in our society. We prided ourselves in a strong middle class coming out of World War II. GI benefits really helped build a strong middle class. And today, the report by the Fed is that, you know, we've gone from 25% of our society middle class to about 14%, result of loss of jobs, inadequate savings, et cetera. Are we losing our middle class, and how do we restore it?
I tend to think of it in slightly different terms. And Austin and I talked about this a little earlier. I think the post-World War II experience was more of an anomaly than the norm in our economic history. That I don't know how vibrant the middle class was prior to World War II. I don't know how vibrant it was as we were switching from an agricultural society to an industrial society, where some people made more money going into manufacturing, but others lost it, leaving, you know, not being able to leave the farm. So I think that after the productive capacity of the world was destroyed, pardon me, you know, we had the world to ourselves. We at one point had more than 50% of global GDP with 5% of the population. And so until the rest of the world came back online, I think that was ours to own. And so I think some of this has been a certain right sizing of the global economy. Some of it had to do with trade deals. Some of it had to do with globalization, mechanization, technological innovation that's displaced people. I think the real problem with respect to restoring the middle class is adequate education, and we've talked about this before, and retraining so that people can take advantage of the new industries that are growing and lever whatever skills they can develop, either in a transitional education program or in college, so that they can be in the right industry at the right time. I don't think we can restore the middle class the way it was, where a high school graduate can go work at a GM assembly line, get cradle-to-grave benefits effectively in some form or another, and an above-market wage relative to the rest of the world. But I think we need a much more enlightened view of how we get people to where they need to be so they can access high-value, high-paid jobs, which is something we've done really not, we've not been terribly aggressive or terribly effective at in the last several decades.
Austin, middle class?
I mean, it is such an important topic that I'm glad you raise it, but there's a lot of things swirling around on this subject. Partly, this Fed statistic is just how do you define what the middle is. My dad is a very big guy, and he's really inflexible, and his doctor told him he should go do yoga. And so my dad goes to yoga, and he says, you know, I'm kind of don't know if I want to do this because I think it's gonna hurt. You know, I'm not a flexible, I'm a big guy. And the yoga instructor said, no, there is no pain in yoga. And my dad said, well, that's good. I'm glad because I gotta. And so then he starts whatever it is. He says, he's like, I'm definitely feeling some pain. And the guy says, no, there is no pain in yoga. And I was like, okay, if you just define it not to exist, you know, then it doesn't exist. That said, the middle class, we had a long time where in the data, the top has been, at least since the 1970s, the top has been doing great. The bottom has been doing quite badly. But the broad middle largely did about as well as the economy did. So when we're having booms, that's going up, and we're having recessions, it's going down. And sometime around starting at the beginning of the 2000s, continuing through that, getting worse in the recession and continued, we've had booms where the median family income is not going up. That basically 85% of the economy, 85% of the people's incomes are flat at best, and a bunch of them going down. That feels very socially unstable to me. And I think a lot of that's from technology. I personally think only a very small part of that is from globalization, because the vast majority of the U.S. economy does not face global competition. But nothing could be more important than this. I think this is why in surveys, you ask people, how do you feel like the world is? How do you feel like it will be for your kids? There's a very sour mood, and I think it comes from this.
Mitch?
Yeah, I'm worried about it. I think that, and I say that from the standpoint of, I saw the term recently, techno-optimist. I've always been that. A dynamic economy, the whole rise of this country economically has been based on waves of innovation. Every time one came, people worried. could see what might go away. You couldn't see what was coming. And yet we've always replaced with more opportunity whatever was creatively destroyed. And so, operating on faith, I'm inclined to believe it's going to happen again, but I can't see it coming. And I can certainly see a lot this time that might be different. You know, a lot of the job categories that have grown the fastest in this really anemic so-called recovery are the most easily automated and are among the most easily automated. Retail and food service and phone call centers are three that are sometimes cited. So, I won't draw an easy breath until we do begin to see large numbers of high-paying jobs created. I don't want to see us drift back, and maybe, you know, Ron may be right. Maybe we've lived through the aberration. Maybe we're going to drift back to Victorian England, where there's a, you know, one class doing fine, and a lot of people have jobs, but it's sort of service jobs to support the rest. It's, you know, look where we are. We're in the cockpit of economic inequality out in this part of the country. Somebody calculated that there's 13 or 14 or 15 or something people at Instagram, all of whom are worth more than George Eastman was on his richest day when he employed a couple hundred thousand people at Eastman Kodak. So more power to them. People like that have invented wonderful things that have enriched life for the rest of us, but a huge amount of wealth went to a very, very few people. It had nothing to do with tax policy, right? It wasn't because the fix was in. It's the nature of the economy we're in now, so-called winner-take-all in many, many markets. And, you know, the question is, where will this wonderful innovation trigger the kind of opportunity for large, large numbers of other people? And, you know, I'm hoping, but it's hard to see.
I think that's true. I would add, you may not want me to add, but there is a major debate going on in economics, which is about price indices, which you're eventually going to say, oh, God, price indices. But it actually it matters a lot because, you know, when my grandpa used to tell me, we'd go to the movies, and they'd be like, you know, it's $11. He'd be like, $11? When I was a kid, a movie cost a nickel. And I'd be like, but that was a silent movie. You know, and it was like, it was black and white. So, I mean, we have to somehow account for it. We know what your salary is, but does that make you better off or worse off than you were 30 years ago or 50 years ago? And so there's a famous book on economic growth that opens with Nathan Rothschild, the richest man in the world, taking a train to somewhere, and he bangs his back, and he gets some kind of a boil, and he's scratching it, and he goes to the doctor, and they try to poke it, and it gets infected, and it turns a gangrene or something, and he dies of a thing that the poorest person in America will walk into the emergency room for 25 cents, maybe not the same 25 cents, but, you know, 25 cents.
He should have tried yoga.
Yeah, try yoga. 25 cents, you're cured. So in that sense, is the poorest person in America richer in real terms than the richest man in the world was in 1830? You know, that's actually a question of price indices, and it's harder.
We love it when you talk about price indices.
I just don't want to leave the impression that I believe we're going back to that period where there was no middle class. I actually think that the future looks actually quite bright. Austin's talking about hedonic adjustment here, which is what they like to call in economics, where the car that you buy today for $20,000 is infinitely better than the car you bought 40 years ago or 30 years ago or 20 years ago for $20,000 because it has more. Your iPhone is way better than transistor radio. You know, there's a lot of things that have changed. Quality's gone up and prices come down. That's made a difference to the middle class.
Yeah. Let me take a quick break here to recognize our question review team. They're the people that select the questions that I'll present to my speakers. And I'd ask you to hold your applause until I introduce each of them. Julie Copeland, who's city editor of the Santa Cruz Sentinel, Doug McKnight, who's a reporter for KZU Radio, Don Miller, who's executive editor of the Monterey Herald, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, and Amy Wu, who's the government reporter for the Salinas Californian. If you would thank them, I would appreciate it.
You tell them, Mr. Secretary, the pressure's on them. We had the students in here this afternoon.
Yeah, no, I was
they
just
set a standard of question asking that is, we're going to see if they can match.
Well, we had a great group of students this afternoon who did ask some great questions. And what I would like to do, we have some of them who come to the evening show, so I'd like to ask all of the students in attendance if they would stand and remain standing until I recognize the schools that are being represented. Could you stand wherever you are? Great. These students come from Defense Language Institute, the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, Monterey, Monterey Coast Preparatory School, Monterey High School, Navy Postgraduate School, Pacific Grove High School, San Jose State University, San Lorenzo Valley High School, Santa Catalina School, Santa Clara University, Stevenson School, and the University of California at Santa Cruz.